Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. This is the first podcast of 2024, and I'm very happy to be well rested, for one thing. but I'm really happy to be kicking off the year with Amy Talbin. Hello, Amy.
Hi, Nick. Happy to be kicking off the year with you, too.
I think sometimes we've done end of year, and now we do beginning of year. It's always amazing how movies from the past year are kind of quickly crowded away by what's coming up. And I don't know if you do have any, state of the nation thoughts or...
Oh, dear. I don't. I mean, there are too many movies, most of them really bad. And, you know, this is a problem I guess we've talked about. It used to be that it was hard for people to get their movies made. But now that digital technology is so easy to use and access, the problem is not getting it made, it's getting it seen. Mm. And there are just too many movies.
Well, it's certainly scaled back in terms of how many of these movies get written about, too, I think. I mean, not that it's like the only way things get written about, but like the policy of every movie getting its review in different publications doesn't really happen anymore. So, yeah, it's doubly hard.
I mean, I just get tons of emails. And if it just says it's some movie I've never heard of, everyone connected to it I've never heard of, and it's VOD only, I trash the email, you know? I mean, and that's terrible. Whereas I used to be totally curious and compulsive about the things that I didn't have time to look at. I mean, it would drive me crazy, guilt-ridden, and just trying to see everything because there might be something hidden away. And indeed, I did find some great movies like that, absolutely great movies. One of them is being, we could talk about this at a later date, but it's being reissued on a brand new Blu-ray. It never was on Blu-ray. It just went to some tiny, tiny festivals. It's called Too Much Sleep. And it played in New York in the Filmmakers Showcase or whatever that is, Wednesday nights at Anthology. And by chance, I saw it. And it's one of the best independent movies I've ever seen. And I'm so thrilled that it's being reissued. And I have no idea where I'll be able to write about it. Because, you know, I quit Art Forum because they fired wonderful David Belasco. And I am loyal to my editors. And that was a crime. And it gets very, very hard to find places to write about films that no one knows anything about. In other words, you used to be able to do that, to get press around a film that no one had ever heard of, and suddenly something happened. And now it's just impossible.
Yeah, it does seem that things have to be a known quantity or be attached to something that's already getting traction in some way, and metrics, you know, all the usual suspects.
Or being released by A24. I mean, that's it.
I mean, there are many distributors, but just I just wish there were other ways of movies getting that kind of profile. Yeah, I don't know. It's a rough situation. Yeah, it's how do you surface a movie? How do you advocate for a movie? You know, how do you make a movie that's not seen by a lot of people be seen by more people? That seems to be a slight flaw in the system. But Too Much Sleep, that's from like late 90s, right? Or
I don't remember anything except that it was extraordinary. It is a narrative movie.
Yeah.
About, you know, a person who is something of an outsider or feels like he is one. And I remember nothing else.
You know, but it's funny. I was just talking with someone about this, that remembering movies, it's like, do you remember every single great meal you had? And it's like, well, no, you didn't, but it like stuck with you. It nourished you, but yeah, maybe you don't remember every single thing. I kind of like that, I guess. I don't know.
I think it's so unfair.
Yeah, it is true. Yeah. Well, maybe we can talk about a movie that I think we've both seen or re-seen recently, and that is going to be surfaced in a big way, get a film forum revival run.
Opening with one of the co-producers, Pat Hartley, who was the longtime partner, wife of the director. She's going to be there presenting it. And then I think he's got 2 weeks at Film Forum. Yeah.
Yeah, and the film is called I Heard It Through the Grapevine. It's, I guess, a new restoration as well.
The Harvard Film Archive restored it, and the director is Dick Fontaine. He died in October, very sadly.
He did, yeah.
Yeah, he was really, really amazing, a documentarian. Really one of the people who in Britain brought cinema verite style of filmmaking to TV. And his work was very important in that period of British TV where you had Channel 4 and the BBC doing really innovative things. And then he taught. I was a big Dick Fontaine enthusiast. He taught at the National Film School for 20 years. And when he died, the tributes from his students over the years were really extraordinary. I mean, he taught a lot of people how to make documentary films. And Anthology Film Archives had a retrospective of his, I think, last year.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. I remember now.
And some of the best known are essentially films about Black artists. So jazz films about Sonny Rollins and Ornette Coleman. And he also made films about Black political radical activists. There's a short film about George Jackson's funeral at, I think, a church in New York, at the Riverside Church in New York. I mean, he just made amazing films, but this is one of the truly great ones. The Sonny Rollins documentary is tremendous, but this film, I Heard It Through the Grapevine, is really tremendous.
Yeah, and yeah, just another like a footnote to the work you mentioned for British television. I think he worked on World in Action.
Yes.
This kind of history is now kind of like, which is a series I think that Paul Greengrass started in, I believe. But I heard it through the grapevine from 1982. I saw it at Berlin, I think, where the restoration premiered last year, just about a year ago, and it's really incredible. And it's film. I think in some ways couldn't or wouldn't really be made now. I mean, not just because it's capturing re a really particular period, that's the whole point of it, but also just it's just frankness, I guess. It's kind of like
Yeah.
emotional frankness.
Oh, I think it's just amazing. I mean, I think it's amazing. It's even more amazing if you've seen Raoul Peck's really great documentary, I Am Not Your Negro. And if you've seen it, you know that obviously James Baldwin was dead for many, many years when Raoul Peck made his documentary. So he was using all existing footage and with a voiceover. A very good voiceover because he didn't really try to imitate Baldwin. And it was Sam Jackson, I think, who did the voiceover. But it was at one remove. And that film begins with a piece of existing footage, which I now realize came from Dick Fontaine's film,
Oh, wow.
where Baldwin is talking to an editor, and it's toward the end of his life. And he's not in great health, but he says he wants to make a trip and go through all the places in the South where he visited and was involved in the civil rights struggle. And here, this film begins with that, but Dick Fontaine is recording James Baldwin as he speaks. In other words, it isn't at one remove. I don't even know how to say this. Obviously, it was recorded back in time, in the 80s, but it is Baldwin actually saying this on camera for this film. And then, like a cinema verite, Dick Fontaine goes and Pat Hartley, who actually made the connection of Baldwin to Dick Fontaine, they travel with Baldwin on this journey through the South and through all the significant and horrific places of the civil rights struggle.
Yeah, they'd go to Atlanta, but then it's like Birmingham, Selma.
Yeah. But they also meet I mean, Baldwin meets all these people that he knew back in those years now.
Yeah.
And some of them are famous as part of the civil rights struggle, and some of them are not. But it is the sense of this, these long friendships and this camaraderie that is recorded in this film that is just remarkable and so moving. And also a part of, an argument in the civil rights struggle, but it's now pretty lost. That anti-integration argument from Black Power. And one of the early things in the film is the problem in Atlanta, where after integration, the prosperous Black neighborhoods, the restaurants and businesses, that neighborhood just collapsed because of the possibility of just going downtown to the heart of Atlanta, and you no longer had to be in a Black neighborhood. And it was absolutely so destructive of Black businesses and Black neighborhoods in Atlanta. And that was so interesting because I kind of had forgotten about that part of the Black Power movement.
Yeah, and then of course it wasn't necessarily reciprocated. It wasn't.
Right.
So
No, it was certainly not.
that's kind of a refrain in the movie, is returning to these neighborhoods. And that's one of the things in the filmmaking that's so impressive, is the way that it kind of folds the footage from the past of, like, storefronts, or I don't know, courthouse steps or sidewalks, right into, like, what they're shooting now as Baldwin is visiting them. It's really pretty fluid, and I thought pretty complex, this nesting of, like, the past and the present and inside each other.
Yeah, and they go to Alabama and Mississippi, but they go not only to, the cities, they go to farm country. I mean, they meet people in farm country, and it really is one of the most extraordinary films, partly because it's Baldwin, and although he is clearly not in good health, he is extraordinarily outgoing and so involved in going back to this formative for him piece of history.
Yeah, there are conversations he has, or even just, he doesn't even have to say anything. I think there's one time where he's talking with Reverend Fred Shuttleworth,
Yep.
who is talking about, here's where, the bomb went off when they tried to kill me. And he said, I sort of kept trying to combat evil or hate. And then they pan over to Baldwin, and he doesn't say anything. I mean, he just kind of gives a slight sigh or something, or just, what do you say after that, Also, just talking about the idea that of fighting and dying for the right to vote, and then what is there to vote for, is another kind of refrain in the movie.
Into the present.
Yeah, I know. I mean, that's the thing. Like, there's just a, I don't know what you say. Is it pessimism? I mean, or just justified cynicism about what's the future at this point? Again, like in '82, Reagan having just been elected, probably just as they were going around, or just after. I think they have it on the, he shows up on a TV. I don't know if he's already been elected or not.
I think he's already been elected.
I don't know. There's a really harrowing sequence about James Cheney's murder.
Oh, that's extraordinary because that's a piece of history. I didn't know that James Chaney's younger brother, who you see at the funeral, and is such a beautiful boy, and he is weeping. I mean,
Yeah.
it's younger brother, and then you find out that at the time the movie is being made, this movie, I heard it through the grapevine. They know that he's been arrested on a murder charge in Florida, and they don't know if he's going to be found guilty or not. But you've just seen this absolutely just beautiful boy who's just distraught, and his belief in everything has been shattered, that anything is possible has been shattered by the murder of his older brother. I think that's one of the most extraordinary things I've ever seen.
Yeah, and in the movie they're kind of weaving that history in with, that's when Baldwin's visiting David Dennis, and then they show David Dennis giving a speech after James Chaney's death at the funeral that you're talking about, and he's overcome and has to kind of end his speech. But yeah, just that idea that Ben Chaney lost any faith after that, and that's just kind of like the real backbeat of the movie, which also has, there's a lot of music in the movie as well.
And it's interesting. It's not music by people who are famous. I mean, it's music by local church choirs and small groups. It's not like big stars who have come to rallies and stuff like that. And the music is amazing.
It's great. It is like a complicated movie in terms of its editing. I mean, I think you mentioned that it did not get a good review. I don't know if you meant the Times for in 82, but it's shifting and shuttling, and it's you really have to keep your eye on the ball in terms of what is voiceover with an audio of now, Baldwin talking now, and when they're weaving in things from the past. I mean, it's really skillfully done, but I think it's a kind of tapestry that you don't really see so much now. I honestly think that it's trying for like a multi-layered sort of thing that just doesn't happen much now. I think because there's just a great anxiety over whether people will follow with it. I don't think it's like muddled editing here. It's just like very layered and intricate.
Jake Perlin, who's distributing this through his company. I mean, the film was restored and preserved by the Harvard Film Archive, and Jake is taking this on as a distributor. And what he told me was that the film came out at a low point in the US for the appreciation of James Baldwin's writing. I mean, his reputation wasn't at a great place. And he felt that the first reviews of the film were conditioned by that. Then I looked up Canby's review in the Times, which was when the film came out. And it wasn't a bad review, it was just not all that enthusiastic. And so the film just kind of died. I mean, documentaries really didn't have big theatrical runs in those days. And so, when I Am Not Your Negro came out, that was a period. This is a period when you can open a documentary in theaters and it will do reasonably well. And I know what Jake Perlin is planning to do. It'll run at the Film Forum for at least 2 weeks. And then he has theaters lined up all over the US before it goes to become a Blu-ray or stream or anything. It'll go into basically art theaters and community theaters, community centers all around the country.
That's great, because I do think it's a movie that can find in more of an audience now, maybe than yeah in the early 80s. But it is a movie that like it's not like the movie sends you out like on the usual note of documentaries now, which are like, but there's hope for the future or something. Like a huge part of this movie is just talking about losing hope, or Bolden says something like, I expect nothing from them. I expect everything from us. But yeah, so that's I heard it through the grapevine, and I didn't know as much about Pat Hartley as I should have. But second or third result was that Warhol All Stars page.
Yeah, I think I'm going to meet her and interview her at some point because we did not cross paths at the Warhol factory. She came there slightly later than I did. And I think at the time she was kind of between high school and college, and she was also a model, but she was one of two Black women who ever came to the factory. She and Dorothy Dean. That was it. And I didn't cross paths with her there because I was in and out, like in the fall of 64 and, just had it in 3 weeks. And I think she came slightly later and she was in some Marcy films. And then there's a big interview with her in Lynn Tillman, the novelist, collaborated with Stephen Shaw, the photographer, on this wonderful book that I think is out of print now called The Velvet Years, which is Stephen's photographs of the factory during those years. And Lynn interviewed some people and then put their interviews into first person form and just ran them. And Pat was one of them. And her interview was really fantastic because she was 18, and she said it's the most amazing thing she said was that people always talk about the factory being dangerous and, people are doing drugs and hurting each other and whatever. And she said, the place that I live, that's where it was dangerous. The factory was someplace where I felt safe. You could just go up there and do whatever you wanted to do, and no one ever bothered you or asked you to do anything else. And I think in part she was talking about being a straight woman in basically a gay male place where no one was hitting on her. But it kind of was an amazing perspective.
Yeah, that really puts things in perspective. And they made, with Dick Fontaine, they made a few documentaries together, is that right?
Yeah.
All right. Well, yeah, I hope people catch it at Film Forum or wherever people might be when it hits the road. I guess also it's the James Baldwin Centennial this year. So that's one thing you've been watching. What else do you want to mention?
I'll just very quickly do a teaser. I'm not going to Sundance, but I will do it remote. But now they're being so chintzy about it
Oh,
because
yeah.
they really want people to come and be in Park City, which I never want to do again. And so I don't get to see anything till the second half of the festival. But I did see Steven Soderbergh's Presence, which is premiering at Sundance in the early days. And I don't really want to talk about it because it's all surprise.
Okay.
And I was like so surprised by it, even though people may not be, but I was. So I don't really want to talk about what it is, except to say that Soderbergh has made a series of films. I mean, he shoots and edits all his own films now, regardless of what kind of camera he uses, blah, blah, blah. But there is a series of films that's made with very small cameras and very mobile cameras. So I will just say that this is a variation on that that is extraordinary, that makes me think of it as a combination of, well, if Michael Snow had decided to remake The Shining or Carrie, that's all I'll say.
Well, that's pretty amazing. Yeah, while you were talking, I was like, oh, wow, I'm trying to remember what exactly. Now I'm matching it with what the log line is, which is one of the shortest.
Yes. Basically, he says a family move into a suburban house and discovers that they may not be alone.
Yeah. That's premiering on the Friday, so like the very first weekend. That's when I'm going to see it. But yeah, I appreciate the preservation of the surprises. Sounds like pretty fun cast too, it sounds like. So that's our glimpse of Presence, new Steven Soderbergh movie. And then I think you were also talking about a TV show that you had been watching.
Oh, I really like Fellow Travelers.
Yeah.
I think Fellow Travelers is just amazing.
It's a historical one, like US history or.
Yeah, the period that it covers is from the early 1950s, from the Lavender Scare, particularly in Washington, D.C., when, you weren't allowed to have a government job if you were a homosexual, right? So it was about the closet in Washington during the McCarthy period, around 52. And it ends in San Francisco at the beginning of the AIDS crisis. And there's one main couple and a supporting couple, and they are both gay. But the main couple, because Matt Bonner, who is just great in this, is totally closeted and determined to stay totally closeted. It's hard to say in the beginning that these two guys, this guy he meets, is a couple, with him. But of course he is. And it is a great love story between these two guys who are totally unalike and are madly in love and have the most fantastic gay sex that I've ever seen in a movie. I mean, it's not a movie, it's a TV series. It's an 8 episode. It is just fantastically erotic. And, you see a lot of stuff. And not so much from the secondary couple who are black. And one of them is closeted, a school teacher and a journalist, actually a journalist for a living, who just wants to keep his job, who's lover is, I mean, in those days, a drag entertainer. They are incredible as well. The actors are fantastically great. The direction is great. The writing is the best television writing I've ever seen. And the way the first episode begins, it just goes back and forth with no middle between 1952 and 1982. And then gradually in the next episodes, the middle years get filled in, but you still have that sense of moving in time. And it's just brilliantly edited because you're never at a loss for where you are. So how these relationships happen and the things that were left out about how they got from 52 to 82 gradually gets filled in. It's an amazing structure. It is so brilliant and it is so very sexy and so heartbreaking, so heartbreakingly yearning. And in a way, it's also a horror series about the closet and the destructiveness of the closet. The Matt Bona character is really complicated because he gets married and has two kids, and he wants to keep pulling this off. And so I'm not going to give away the ending, but
Wow.
and the young man who Matt Bona picks up in a bar, and he's come to Washington wanting to work in government, and Matt Bona kind of wants to keep him handy, so he gets him a job with McCarthy. Even though Matt Bona is working for a liberal senator
Oh,
and
wow.
he's a liberal himself, but he gets this guy who is a tortured Catholic because he is gay, a job with McCarthy. And so this much younger guy, well, probably not that much younger, starts off as totally right wing and then flips, you know, has some experiences. Gets out of Washington, enlists in the war, comes back and hooks up with a kind of religious figure who's kind of like Daniel Berrigan, the Berrigan brothers, and burns his draft card and does some things and goes totally over to the left. And in San Francisco, you know, works in a gay support clinic at the beginning of the AIDS crisis. I mean, it's great. And the actor who's really British is really fantastic. Jonathan Bailey, who plays this much more complicated character than the Matt Bona character, in the sense of changing over the course of these 30 years, is, I think, a great actor.
Wow.
Yeah.
And this one, I guess, is created by Ron Niswonner.
He's the person who wrote Philadelphia. He started off with a very, very big Hollywood career and dropped out of sight for 20 years. I don't know why. And kind of came back with this.
Wow. You look at his IMDb, and it's The Painted Veil is the last thing I kind of recognize. I guess he wrote for Homeland a bit.
And he's the showrunner and he wrote the entire series. And an ex-student many years ago of mine, who's was enormously talented and obviously still is, directed the first two episodes. Dan Minahan, he's one of many executive producers as well. So this is great. Years ago, he did a series about Halston that I didn't think worked, but this is absolutely brilliantly directed. I'm so knocked out by it.
What course did he take with you, or was it a number of courses, or?
Yeah, he took a bunch of courses. I think I was teaching something like film and literature and then avant-garde film. And he made several films at SVA that were wonderful.
That's great. What's the course you're teaching now there?
I got to teach four courses this semester because
Oh,
I have
geez.
no money because art forum I quit.
All right.
I teach a graduate course, which I really like, which is, you know, where the art world and film history meet, kind of. So it's anything goes.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah, no, I really like that course. And I teach a women in film, women directors course. And I teach history of genre, which I've never taught before, beginning in the 50s. So it's a history, but it's arranged as genre. And of course, which is film course that students, why are we talking about this?
I just
Students
asked you.
who major in something that's called 3D visual digital effects.
Okay.
And they have to take one film course, and most of them have never sat through a feature film in their lives. And I had a student tell me last semester that he didn't know that there had been color films before this century.
Like before 2000?
Yes.
Wow. And he'll be making a movies that everyone will see soon.
So some of them are awed by seeing, say, the red shoes, but most of them just cannot sit for 2 hours. I mean, they have no comprehension about why they should or why they would. They just have no interest.
Well, you're doing the Lord's work there. actually, I should just take one of your courses. That art history one, that sounds really cool. That must be a ton of work, though. I mean, that's just like,
Unfortunately, it is, you
yeah.
know.
So maybe one last kind of group of things we can talk about. On the Criterion Channel, they do this kind of retrospective look at films that have been in Sundance, but not like recently, more like, I guess, all the way back to the 80s and 90s in terms of, and these are movies that honestly I've found difficult to find elsewhere for in a number of cases. So yeah, I was curious if you had looked at that at all and if anything caught your eye there or that you remembered liking then or anything like that.
I mean, pretty much, this is a good list. It's not exactly the same. Sundance asked, I don't know if they asked you, but they asked a lot of critics to
Yes, they did, yeah.
write what their favorite Sundance movies were or what their most memorable Sundance screenings were.
Right.
So my most memorable Sundance screenings still are Donnie Darko, Kids, Poison, and Safe. And none of them are on the Criterion list.
Oh.
But I mean, it's a list that begins before Sundance was Sundance, when it was just changing from being a regional, we called it the Granola Festival, to realizing that there was New York and people in New York made movies and there was San Francisco and out there they were mostly making documentaries. And so in the 80s, so you got films like Jim Jarmusch's Stranger Than Paradise, and you got Blood Simple, films that you really don't associate now with Sundance because it was called something like the American Film Festival. And then Sex, Lies, and Videotape, which is, I don't think it's on this list, even though it is a Criterion Blu-ray now, really good restoration. But that was 89. And then there were a bunch of films all clustered together in 91 that are really, really good. And they are Paris is Burning, which is misidentified in the Criterion list as being from 1990, but it was actually 1991. I know because I was on the jury that gave it the grand prize.
Oh, wow.
And it was the same year as Slacker and Poison. And seeing Slacker and then seeing Poison, one right after another, was, I mean, these were films that people were really just going in and saying, I'll do anything. This is what I want a film to be. And so you'd get something like Poison in three parts, and the parts didn't exactly relate. But you know, you knew that this was an extraordinary filmmaker. And I remember Gus Van Sant was on the fiction jury that year that I was on the doc jury when we gave it to Paris is Burning. And everyone was very surprised because Gus wanted to give the award to Slacker and not to Poison. We thought Gus, being gay, would want to give it to Poison, but he was just totally in love with the kids from Slacker. I mean, it was interesting at that point because everyone just came out swinging and no, people were reasonably fearless. So it was just much, much looser. I love My Crazy Life by Jean-Pierre Garin.
Oh,
That's
yeah.
on this list. Oh, and then there were films that were just, I didn't think The Blair Witch Project was really great, but I knew that there would be 100 Blair Witch projects after it.
Right.
So you saw stuff like that.
Yeah, that sounds like one for the genre course.
Yeah, and Chameleon Street, which recently got a revival at Film Forum and is a lovely film. And I remember Peter Wallin was on the fiction jury that year. And he said, you know, we do have black filmmaking in England, but we don't have anything like this. I mean, Chameleon Street isn't a great film, but it is another one of those films that was like nothing you'd ever seen before.
Yeah, no, I think that feels pretty cool. That's definitely also gotten a push like on the Criterion Channel. I just going back to the being forced to choose between Slacker and Poison. I mean, yeah, not a choice I envy. I mean, I guess Safe has been on Criterion a bit lately.
Oh, that's interesting about Sundance. This year, Richard Linklater's new film is going to be there. That was in the New York Film Festival, and I just think it's one of his best films.
Oh yeah, Hitman.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is so much fun. Maybe we can reconnect after Sundance. I do want to just give my little report from the front lines of multiplex front lines for a change of pace. We were talking in the beginning a bit about, trying to obsessively catch up with things or make sure you're seeing everything that's coming out that you wanted to see. And in my case, the one movie that I just definitely want to catch up at some point, I mean, almost because I did think it was kind of going to be fun, was Napoleon, starring Joaquin Phoenix, who I still feel like I'm curious to see what his performance is. Although this might be a movie where I'm no longer curious anymore. I mean, directed by Ridley Scott, so I thought, at least the large scale like action is going to be kind of interesting. And it's true, I would say like. My favorite part of this movie was the Austerlitz battle scene, which is it's pretty incredible. It's on a like frozen lake or near a frozen lake, and what he does in cutting between like the on ground like wintry battle and just people crashing through the ice is pretty incredible. Like it becomes almost abstract when people are like floating in the water. It's just like these swishing, swirling shapes of color in the kind of icy depths. So that was impressive. The movie as a whole, I just sort of didn't understand where the time went, and I don't even think they mentioned the metric system. But the weirdest thing about it, and the reason probably why I stayed just as in horror as much as anything else, is that I was seeing it at the only screen that it's now playing in New York, at least as of last week, and that's at the Regal Union Square, which the reports of its death, were greatly exaggerated. It's all in like blue light and neon light bars and things like that. This particular screen is Screen X. I guess I keep thinking of that medication, Gas X, but it's called Screen X. And what Screen X is, it's basically like a wide screen using all three walls of the room, but it's not a wraparound screen. It's a box. Like you are in a box-shaped room. And about two-thirds of the image that's being projected is on the wall right in front of you. And the other third is split between your left wall and your right wall. And not only is it split, but it's like stretched. I guess on the assumption that it's in your periphery, so you maybe won't be looking directly at it anyway. And also so it can stretch. It's stretched so that it can surround you. I was sitting more or less in the middle, so I couldn't even see unless I were to turn the entire image.
Absurd.
Needless to say, this is a terrible idea for exhibiting a movie. And it's the sort of thing where I came out afterwards and I was like, should I write someone a letter? Like, I feel like I have to tell someone involved with this movie what this actually looks like, what's being done with the movie, because I couldn't believe it. There is one exit sign in the middle of the left wall. In the middle, like, you'll see horses riding and through an exit sign. And on the right, I think there were actually two exit signs. And on top of that, I sort of realized that the stretched images on the left and right were also lower res. I'm fairly certain about this. And that would almost make sense because I can only imagine that they did not want to shell out money for a top of the line projector just for the left and right walls. I'm sure it's a great projector for the center wall. But I'm not certain those projectors for the left and right, they're separate projectors, are like top notch as well.
So rather than junking their last generation projectors, they figured out how to make a different screen where they could keep them in use.
I think you nailed it. That is probably exactly what's happening. Yeah. Because a couple of times, I was just like, okay, what does this image actually look like? So I would turn to the left, and it was this like just like stretched out, skewed image that was not as good quality. That's probably what's happening.
Well, poor Ridley Scott, I can't imagine that he knows about this, or at least I hope he doesn't.
I can't. I mean, and that's the thing with the Regals. I mean, I guess it's maybe the AMC, but I mean, if you ever looked at the ticket options recently, like they give you five different things where it's like you can see it in like Digi 3D or 3DigiD or something. They're like 20 different names for things, and you need like a dictionary to figure out what it actually means, the gloss, and all of which are just pretexts for ramping up the prices. And I mean, maybe in a couple cases it was because, projection was so bad, but I mean, if this is an example, it's not improving it. The one thing I will say is that I don't know, maybe someone was thinking this, but as you know, with the Abel Gance version of Napoleon,
Right.
that was shown on, at some
Oh my
point,
God.
right?
Well, and three screens, yes. So maybe someone was thinking about that.
I mean, I hope so because it makes it like slightly less bad. Those screens, at least in like snapshots, I've seen it. They did recreate that at some point in the past 10, 15 years. And the whole point of that also was like it was like this orchestral like climax where like it would be the tricolor, the flag. In this case, yeah, I guess it was just to use their old projectors. I mean, it should be, I guess it could theoretically be immersive, but I just felt like I was always missing. I felt like I was watching pan and scan,
Yeah. Well, no, it's kind of like, oh, I don't know, a bad light show, when you go out dancing. And they're projecting on three walls, and they couldn't keep it on the just the front wall, so it spills over onto the side walls intentionally or unintentionally. That's kind of what this sounds like.
It is something like that. And it did inadvertently make me think about framing, just how much is he thinking of the center part of the image. And I don't think he's expecting cropping because I guess by now mostly it's not as egregious as it used to be. But then I thought of how like Kubrick did used to like think of framing in terms of how it would look on a TV because he knew that it would look different on a TV. So there are these images of like Kubrick's notations on things of how he would frame like parts of The Shining, knowing that it would be cropped. So how to make it at least acceptable. But in this case, I don't think Ridley Scott was ever anticipating Screen X. So there you
Oh,
have it.
God.
But now I have technically seen it. Well, we can wrap up there unless the. I mean, there are a bunch of things that are coming out this month. There's like an interesting Vietnamese movie, Inside the Yellow Cocoon.
I liked Totem very much when I saw it
Yes.
last year, and it's coming out very soon.
That's a good one. But yeah, thank you, Amy, for bringing the new year to a suitably festive start.
Have a great time in Sundance, Nick. I kind of envy you. And we'll talk about it in a couple of weeks.
Okay, sounds good.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with host Nicholas Rapold. You can support the podcast by signing up at rapold.substack.com. Thank you for listening.